Hi, this is Mark Hertzgard, and it's the Friday Media Roundtable here at Your Call. Welcome. We are talking about gun violence in America today. On Wednesday, the United States experienced two mass shootings on opposite coasts. Just outside Washington, D.C., a man named James Hodgkinson targeted GOP congressmen and staffers who were practicing for a charity baseball game. Firing a semi-automatic rifle, Mr. Hodgkinson wounded four people, including the majority whip of the House of Representatives, Steve Scalise, who is now in critical condition. Mr. Hodgkinson himself died from injuries after a shootout with Scalise's security detail. On that very same day, a UPS employee in San Francisco entered the UPS facility on Potrero Hill, where he shot and killed three people, injured others, and then turned the gun on himself. Mass shootings inevitably attract lots of media coverage, but in fact, most gun violence in the United States is targeted at individuals. On average, 93 people are shot and killed every day in this country. More than 100,000 people are shot every year. So, how does the media cover this? Often, after these events, they trigger heated discussions of gun control, pros and cons, politicians, and sometimes even journalists playing rather predictable roles, and then the dialogue fizzles. Today, we want to talk about whether journalists can help take that conversation further, and we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear in moments like this? How can we move this conversation about violence and gun rights and gun control and mass shootings forward? Joining us today, we have an excellent panel of experienced journalists on this question. Let me introduce them in turn. First, joining us by phone from the East Bay, Mark Fulman. He's the National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine. Since 2012, he's done in-depth investigations into mass shootings, child gun deaths, and the financial costs of gun violence. His latest piece for Mother Jones is titled, "Anti-Trump Rage May Not Adequately Explain the Congressional Shooting." Mark Fulman, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And from the Los Angeles Times, Curtis Lee, he's a political reporter at the Times. Previously, though, he was a member of the Denver Post staff that won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for breaking news coverage of the Aurora Theater shooting there outside of Denver. His recent piece for the LA Times is titled, "Another Shooting, and Once More, Democrats Call for Gun Control While Republicans Defend Gun Rights." Curtis joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. Curtis Lee, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And finally, Amanda Marquardt. She is the politics writer for Salon. She covers American politics, feminism, and culture. Her latest piece for Salon is titled, "Lessons of the Baseball Shooting. Gun violence feeds on itself, and even now Republicans won't listen." Amanda Marquardt joins us from Brooklyn. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And, of course, we want to hear from all of you. What did you make of the media coverage of these two shootings here in San Francisco and outside of Washington, D.C.? What responsibility do you think journalists have in the wake of events like these to connect the dots to a bigger narrative? And can that dialogue continue past the 24-hour news cycle? And finally, what reporting on anything did you see that was done really well this week? A lot of big news out of Washington that we'll be talking about later in the show, including the fact that the Russian investigation, as you just heard in the BBC News summary, is now touching President Trump himself. And also the efforts by the Senate leadership to push through the overhaul of Obamacare with virtually no public scrutiny. So, lots to get on with, and let's start here, as we always do on the Friday Media Roundtable here at Your Call, asking each of our three guests, what piece of journalism did you think that was done particularly well this week? Amanda Marquardt from Salon, could you start us off, please?
Yeah, I would like to recommend a piece that came out on June 16th, which is today, I do believe. Okay, cool. We asked eight Senate Republicans to explain what their health care bill is trying to do, and it's at Vox.com. I really like this piece because the reporters did something very simple. They just went to Capitol Hill, chased down senators, Republican senators, asked them about the Senate bill that is being negotiated in private, and asked them what's in it. And just recorded the stonewalling that you're getting from each and every Republican senator on this. It's frustrating right now to try and cover this health care bill because the Senate Republicans are deliberately hiding it. And the only thing that reporters can do in light of that is highlight the hiding. And this is just a really good example of how to continue to push a story when you're being deliberately kept from the information that you need to cover it.
Very good. And, of course, we'll have links to that story here at the KALW website and your call. Curtis Lee with the Los Angeles Times, what piece would you like to recommend?
Hi, good morning. The piece I was looking at today is actually was written by my colleague David Montero, who's a national correspondent here at the Times. And it's a piece on baseball and how it comes in the wake of this shooting earlier this week outside of Washington, D.C., in which Congressman Steve Scalise was injured, and other folks there were injured while practicing baseball in the morning. And he writes this, it's just a beautifully written narrative piece about how, you know, America, baseball is this national pastime, and it unites the country. And, you know, he just really had some good voices in there. And, you know, it was one of those pieces that just really was well written, and it kind of just brought people together. Obviously, in the wake of these sorts of things, there's a lot of partisanship and polarization. I mean, this country is very, you know, divided on a number of issues right now. I just thought that it was a really well-written piece, and there's this line in his story that says, and he talks about baseball here, it says, "It's also unique in that it reflects the nation's diversity amid a common set of observed rules, as if it were bound by a common constitution, but other observed the latitude of states' rights." And he's just, you know, really talking about the unity that this can bring, and, you know, that at the end of the day, we're all, you know, Americans, and we're all kind of in this together. And I just thought it was a well-written piece that ran on the front page of the Times today.
That's Curtis Lee, a political reporter with the Los Angeles Times. And finally, Mark Fulman, the national affairs editor at Mother Jones. Mark, what did you like this week?
Yeah, you know, there's so much going on with this Russia investigation now. And I don't tend to read a lot of the op-ed pages, but I thought there was a real standout this week from Frank Bruni in the New York Times after Jeff Sessions' testimony on Tuesday, which was extraordinary on a number of levels, that testimony. And what Bruni's piece gets to, I think, so well is just the way that watching Sessions testify kind of revealed how incredibly debased the situation has become for all of the people surrounding Trump, who, you know, for whatever set of calculations chose to join his administration. You know, Sessions was on board the Trump train very early in his campaign, was rewarded with, you know, the attorney general post, the highest prosecutor post in the country, and here we are Tuesday, and Sessions himself is being prosecuted as you know, testifying in front of the Senate. Pretty extraordinary situation, and I think it, you know, Bruni's piece just really got at how a number of people in the administration, H.R. McMaster, Jim Mattis, you know, people who have even more respectable careers and are perhaps less politically polarizing than someone like Sessions, even they have had so much difficulty keeping the taint of Trump's politics off of them. And I think it was just a really interesting moment to take note of that. I'll cheat a little bit, too, and just say on a related note, my colleague David Korn in Mother Jones had a great point of analysis on the Sessions testimony, too. I think something that's been very buried in the media in general about the Russia story, and this was revealed in Sessions' testimony, the level to which the Trump administration has not engaged with the Russia hack, that it just, you know, has shown no interest in apparently in investigating, and, you know, the testimony that they aren't getting briefings on what happened and don't seem to be engaging it in any way. It's just quite extraordinary.
That's Mark Fulman. He's the national affairs editor at Mother Jones Magazine. All of those articles, of course, will be here on our website, yourcallradio.org. Okay, so let's get in and start to talk about the shootings here. Amanda, I'd like to start with you, please. I thought that your piece the other day in Salon was really striking, where you basically lay out that, look, the way that guns are marketed in this country and sold, it is a business, and a big business at that. They are sold as a kind of appealing to macho notions of strength and how you can be the man and control your situation, and that that kind of ties into the way that you can feel if you walk up to a baseball practice and start picking off your perceived political opponents in the case of the Washington, D.C. shooting. Could you talk a little bit about that? And bearing in mind, of course, as I mentioned in my intro, that the shooting in Washington, D.C. was done with a semi-automatic rifle. That is a weapon that is not designed for self-protection. That's designed to kill as many people as possible in a very short time.
Yeah, and semi-automatic weapons, especially rifles like that, are particularly marketed in terms of being these kind of almost, you know, I hate to use the word toy, but they kind of are marketed as toys to sort of feel powerful and manly. As you said, they're not really good for self-defense. They have some amount of use for hunting, but by and large, outside of being used in mass shootings, they're kind of used at gun ranges just for the sheer amount of pleasure that you can get just completely blowing the target away with one of them. And the marketing around these things is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not subtle. You see a lot of ads that will even use words like manly or masculine. I remember, I think it was the AK-47 or a gun like it was being marketed with "Get your man card back," and I think, you know, most of these ads are kind of put in conservative publications. They're aimed pretty explicitly at conservative audiences.
That and yet here we have a self-described, or at least reportedly, this guy was a left-wing political activist. So does that break that narrative?
No, not at all. And that's something that, you know, my editor asked me to grapple with, and I really tried to in the piece, which is, you know, I think these kind of emotional narratives do not fit neatly into partisan boxes. That feeling that I'm frustrated, my party isn't in power, or whatever other thing is causing people to be frustrated. I've been fired. My wife left me. I just have some inchoate feelings of not being as in power as I feel as a man entitled to. And I think the gender issue here is important because most, something like 99% of mass shooters are men. You know, I think that those kind of feelings run right up against gun marketing, which is both explicit, and then through Hollywood and NRA lobbying and other things, just sort of says, if you feel that you're not getting the power and respect that you deserve, here's a gun that will give it to you. People will be afraid of you, which is what is its own kind of dominance and power.
That's Amanda Marcotte with Salon. Curtis Lee of the Los Angeles Times, I know you have to leave us early. I'd like to bring you in now. And, of course, I mentioned before you were part of the team at the Denver Post that won a Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of the Aurora movie theater shooting back in 2013. Can you reflect a little bit on what you've learned since then about mass shootings and related to the shooting in Washington in particular? You wrote in the LA Times on Wednesday, quote, "It's a recurring theme, this kind of violence, that sends partisans to their respective corners after every high-profile shooting. Is there any way for journalism to push past that predictable spot?"
It's interesting because, I mean, this is something that's the trend that we see, like you said in your intro, in the wake of every mass shooting. I mean, in the wake of the 2012 shooting at the Aurora Theater in Colorado, calls for, you know, stricter gun reforms. Months later, we saw Sandy Hook. I mean, that was around the time President Obama had tapped Vice President Joe Biden to oversee, you know, getting some sort of, you know, background check measures passed through Congress. But we saw that stall just time and again. And it's kind of this repeating kind of theme. Democrats say, you know, background checks are needed. And the polls show, I mean, national polls consistently show that, you know, Americans, Democrats and Republicans, you know, support background checks. But there's this pushback from Republicans for those sorts of reforms. Because, I mean, the NRA groups that fund these campaigns are staunchly against it.
And it's just kind of this narrative, time and again, after a shooting, you see where you know, there's these calls for gun control, and it's really been left to the states. I mean, in the wake of those shootings in 2012, Colorado, Connecticut, California passed some of the strictest gun control laws in the country on limits on ammunition magazines, as well as, you know, universal background checks. It seems very much that it falls to the states. I mean, this is just something that consistently is talked about for days, weeks after a shooting, and then we're on to other issues. And right now, in this political environment, I mean, we're seeing conversations about Russia and so many different news cycle changing by the minute. I mean, it's likely that this will possibly just be, you know, looked over until the next high profile shooting. We saw that last year in Florida with the shooting in
Orlando. Yeah, but of course, this time there's the Congress that themselves have been hit, and shouldn't that change it a bit? Can you also, you mentioned that I think New York, California, and Maryland, I think you said, passed stricter gun control laws. Have you followed up on that? Has that led to any decrease in the amount of gun violence in those states?
You know, I think that, you know, these states... They passed these laws feeling like, you know, I think that lawmakers in a lot of these states felt that the need to act. Whether how it's been quantified, I haven't followed closely how it's been quantified, but, you know, in Colorado, there were certainly, it's kind of ground zero for these kinds of shootings at times. I mean, we saw Columbine, we saw the Aurora Theater shooting.
Right.
There's also been, you know, different school shootings in the Denver metro area. And people just felt the need to act, to do something at this point. And Colorado is a very, you know, purplish blue state that is tending much more blue in recent years. But yeah, this is just something that it seems like it's being left to the state quite a bit after high profile shooting.
That's Curtis Lee with the Los Angeles Times. Mark Fulman at Mother Jones, I'd like to bring you in here because you guys have done such great reporting on the whole spectrum of gun violence. And I want to mention this piece, the point you made in your piece the other day that, you know, that a lot of people are fascinating on the fact, quite understandably, that the shooter in the Washington, D.C. incident has apparently volunteered for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Of course, Senator Sanders immediately issued a statement repudiating this action. But you write, quote, "Understanding a rampage shooter's behavior is invariably far more complicated than uncovering evidence of a political point of view or ideology." Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
You know, having looked at mass shootings in particular for several years now and studying these cases, one of the things that I've learned is that it's just an incredibly complex equation when you're trying to explain what caused the attack, what led to the attack, you know, essentially the question of motive. And there are many cases where politics plays into that, but politics by no means explains that alone. And, you know, I think for obvious reasons, with the attack in Washington this week, people were just immediately glomming onto that and, you know, kind of using it to channel their own partisan anger. And I think that's dangerous on a number of levels, but, you know, foremost, if we want to understand how these attacks happen and in order to try to stop them, to prevent them, to reduce them, you know, you really have to look with a clear-eyed view. There were other things that emerged quickly about the background of the assailant in Washington that were more relevant probably than his politics. I mean, the politics may explain who he targeted. We still don't know that. It seems evident that's what he was doing, but investigators will be looking, you know, following up to find out, was this guy planning to attack Congress? Was he surveilling targets? You know, that kind of behavior. But, you know, just as relevant is, if not more relevant, is his background of domestic violence. That's a strong element in many mass shooting cases. People who have those kinds of histories are more likely to commit a crime like this. So, you know, there's a lot that plays into it. And I think, you know, the other issue with the politics being so front and center is that there's a real problem. Another area that I've looked at with this is the way that the media covers these attacks. And there's a growing problem with the way that media coverage and social media influences people who commit mass shootings. And so I think, you know, the intensity around the politics this week puts that on full display in a way that can have detrimental effects too. It shows people who are politically angry that if I do this, I'm going to get an incredible amount of attention, and that's something that a lot of mass shooters seek. So there's some real questions with that, too.
Of course, that's been a factor for mass media coverage of shootings for a long time, but are you saying that, the social media participation in that is making that a stronger trend, a greater temptation for people who might be someone unbalanced to start with?
Anecdotally speaking, yes, and from various experts that I've talked to in the field of threat assessment, which is people who work in mental health and law enforcement, who are actively focused on trying to prevent these attacks. Over the last couple of years, talking to folks in that field, I've heard time and again great concerns about what social media is doing to exacerbate this problem. Because historically, it was the mass media that was putting inordinate attention on the perpetrators of mass shootings. And there's some data going back showing how subsequent mass shooters have cited or emulated previous attackers. That's a phenomenon that's been understood for decades. So there isn't good data yet or broad research yet on how social media is compounding the equation, but there are certainly elements of social media now surfacing in many of these cases. And it warrants further study, for sure.
That's Mark Fullman. He's the National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine. Also joining us today, Curtis Lee. He's a reporter with the Los Angeles Times. And Amanda Marcotte, she's with Salon. If you're just joining us now, I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And this is Your Call, our regular Friday Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show. We'd, of course, like to invite all of you to participate in today's show as well. If you've got questions, comments that you'd like to send us, you can drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. We just have 1 minute, I think, before we go to break. Curtis Lee, are you still with us there? I'd like to get you one more time before you depart. Curtis, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
Yeah. So, Curtis, before you leave, can I just ask you one more time about, as you look sort of prospectively on this kind of coverage, is there a way for us to break out of the predictable corners that people adopt here? And can the media be a constructive force here in trying to push this narrative forward?
You know, I think that we just have to hear out both sides in this. I mean, like I said earlier, it is this reoccurring theme of Democrats going to their corner on this issue and calling for more gun control legislation, and Republicans essentially pushing back against that. Is there something the media can do to change that? I think that it's important to continue to hear this out until maybe some sort of change, you know, does happen. You know, perhaps Republicans hedge on this a little bit in the wake of this shooting this week. But I think that it's something that's going to continue, and it's been going on for years, for decades, and now it's going to continue on. And how this narrative changes, just remains to be seen.
It is striking, though, that there's no other country in the world that has this level of gun violence, and of course, no other country in the world has the level of gun availability that we have here in the United States. 300 million guns, I think, is the latest number. That's about a gun for each person.
Yes.
Is there any way to make that a little more clear in the coverage rather than just he said, she said?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, you look to Europe and countries abroad, I mean, they're not seeing nearly as many, mass shootings or daily shootings that are just not even covered in the media because there are so many guns on the street, and also looking at the data that shows that background checks have prevented people who shouldn't have guns from getting guns, and I think that certainly looking at that and quantifying that data is something that we can do moving forward in reporting.
That's Curtis Lee with the Los Angeles Times. Also joining us this morning, Mark Fullman. He's with Mother Jones and Amanda Marcotte with Salon. We're talking about gun violence in America. This is the Friday Media Roundtable of Your Call Radio. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we want to invite you to call in with your questions, 866-798-8255. or drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. But first, Curtis Lee with the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much for being with us at Your Call this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with your host, Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
Welcome back. This is the Friday Media Roundtable of Your Call Radio. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We've got a couple of callers with us, but first let me just remind you who our guests are today. We had Curtis Lee with the Los Angeles Times. He had to leave early, but still with us for the rest of the show, Mark Fulman. He's the National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine, has been covering gun violence in America for a very long time, a lot of awards on that, and also Amanda Marcotte with Salon, and she writes about American politics and feminism and culture, and she is also covering these shootings this week. So we have two callers so far, and we'll try to get to those, but the rest of you are also warmly invited to join us. But let's start with Catherine in Berkeley. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. First, let me say that I agree with your perspective on gun violence, but one thing that I have yet to hear is about this shooting in San Francisco with the UPS worker. What I've heard is that he allegedly filed, quote, a grievance for excessive overtime. And I'd like to know more about that. I'd like to know how much overtime, what are his working conditions. I'm a worker myself, and I feel like workers, nowhere else in the world are workers really invisible. Our wages have remained stagnant since the 70s. I hear that often, but what does that mean for the worker and consequently the worker's family? And this kind of morphed into the whole thing about the last election where, you know, the Rust Belt voted for, I'm not even going to mention his name, and, there's no real, it's been touched on, but I think also, like, many workers are working two and three jobs to survive. What does that mean? And did this worker really seek fame? I doubt it. I think he was maybe, I want to hear more about that part of.
Okay, so the stress of overtime and working too hard. Amanda Marcotte, why don't you take the first whack at that, please?
I mean, I don't actually know the details of what the shooter's grievances or his history was in terms of his work grievances. I would caution very strongly to overread into that, just as with the political issue and the support of Bernie Sanders of the baseball shooter, because as Mark was saying earlier, the psychology of mass shootings is complicated. It's very rarely about just whatever the sort of surface reasons that the shooter gives. It's often, you know, about dominance, anger, entitlement, and there's obviously a lot of irrationality there. I mean, one of the things that's important to remember is, like, even if there are a couple of things that they threw in the bucket that might sound reasonable to you, what they did was unreasonable and is not productive in any way, shape, or form. Like, if anything, what happens is that it causes a societal backlash against whatever it was that the shooter was on about, because obviously that person is an unreasonable person, and everything that they believed seems a little more unreasonable by dint of that. So,
That's Amanda Marcotte with Salon. I want to read a quick email, and then we'll take a call from Christine in San Francisco, and I want to ask Mark Fulman to address that. But first, email from Jeff Sturm in San Leandro, who says, what superficial coverage there has been of these shootings centers around this nut, is the word he uses, being a supporter of Bernie Sanders and how shaken up Capitol Hill is. I don't recall members of Congress being so shaken when Representative Gabby Gifford took a bullet in the head a couple years ago. I guess things change when the wolf is prowling in their own backyard. That's an email from Jeff in San Leandro. And now we'll go to a call from Christine in San Francisco. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. What I was educated about yesterday in listening to your program, which I frequently do, I don't even have a TV, I don't watch the regular news programs or news programs that a lot of people watch, but I was educated that Australia put a ban on, or that they had a buyback gun policy, which I did not know. And I'm grateful that I learned that through your station and your media, your coverage, because, I mean, that's such a wonderful idea, and I really do think it would help. But clearly, the federal government, I don't think, is going to be on that page. However, individual states can do it, and maybe that's where this needs to go. And if that could be, you know, put out there in the media for people to think about and get a proposition or get state propositions and just try to be autonomous with that and not think rely on the federal government to do anything. At this point, I think that's kind of that's the page I'm on anyway.
That's Christine in San Francisco. Let me get Mark Fulman to address that. Mark Fulman with Mother Jones. You've covered this gun control issue for a long time. Is that the most likely path for reform is to go via states?
Certainly seems that, you know, the states have been more active and successful in passing legislation, although it really going in multiple directions in terms of both, you know, tightening gun restrictions and then also loosening them. You know, even right after the attack in Washington this week, you had a lot of Republican lawmakers talking about loosening gun laws further. So, you know, as you note, the politics of this is very repetitive and has gone on for a long time. And I think, you know, maybe more important at this point to your earlier question about how do we get past that, trying to better understand why these kinds of attacks keep happening. The previous caller raised an interesting point too about how, you know, this UPS worker in San Francisco may not have been seeking infamy or notoriety the way that many mass shooters do. And I think that's a good point because it leads to another point that's really important here, which is the way that I think, you know, we're thinking about the media's role in covering these cases, the politicization of it with, you know, particularly with the event in Washington this week, when it's all seen through that lens of politics and kind of, you know, inordinate, if not sensational media coverage, I think one of the impacts of that is that it creates the sense that this is a viable solution to someone's problems. So an aggrieved worker who, you know, has any number of issues in their life. I mean, lots of people have trouble with their jobs, but that's not seen as the way to deal with it by most people. And I think the more that these cases happen and get the kind of attention they do in that way, the more people the people who are vulnerable to thinking in that direction, you know, may see that as a legitimate solution to their problem.
I'm going to bring in Meg, a phone call from Meg. But first, Mark Fulman, can I just push you for a second on that? What's the answer then for us as journalists? Are we covering it too much? Are we covering it not enough? Or is it the nature of our coverage that needs to be improved?
I think it's the latter. It's, you know, it's a great question, and it's a very difficult question to grapple with. I've thought about it a lot. I've written about it a lot. You know, the media has a duty to cover this problem robustly. It's a serious problem in our society. I mean, it's a fraction of the gun violence problem overall, and yet it has a major impact on our society psychologically, politically, economically, as I've also documented in investigative work. So, you know, the media has a great responsibility to cover and shed light on mass shootings, but how we do it is, I think, a really important and complicated question. One of the things I've written about specifically is really thinking as deliberately as possible about how the perpetrators themselves are covered, because there is there is significant data showing that perpetrators of these crimes often are very in tune with what the media is doing and are influenced by it, and by giving inordinate or sensational attention to the people who commit these acts, it's really exacerbating the problem. So I don't think that the news media can just carte blanche focus on a perpetrator without thinking about, well, what kinds of images of this person am I spreading around? Often shooters will post pictures of themselves posing with guns and trying to look cool or tough, and that's not helpful in terms of the so-called copycat problem. There are a whole range of nuances to be considered, I think, in how we shed light on the people who commit these crimes in order to better understand them.
That's Mark Fullman with Mother Jones Magazine. Let's go now to our next caller, Meg in Oakland. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask, that I've heard comparisons between countries with and without gun control, but in terms of the number of homicides by guns, what about the number of homicides in general?
Mark Fullman, I imagine you're probably the one to tackle that one. Can you talk about how other countries regulate guns and what effects it has?
Well, generally, much more strictly. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how, as the previous caller also asked about Australia's program to buy back guns, and you look at a comparable, wealthy Western society like Great Britain that has very few guns in the civilian population, and they have lower rates of gun violence. I mean, there's a very basic correlation there. The problem with focusing on that, I think, in a basic sense, is that it's just not realistic for the United States. As you mentioned earlier in the show, we have upwards of 300 million guns in this country, and they're very easy to get. We're not even remotely near a kind of political environment where that could change substantively enough to, take us away from a situation where people can get guns easily and often, all kinds of powerful weapons. I think in terms of getting into issues of regulation and the gun control debate, it's, again, a much more complex equation of what can be done to try to mitigate the problem of dangerous people getting guns. And that's a whole range of questions that relate to different kinds of gun violence, whether you're talking about, daily gun violence in Oakland or in Chicago, or you're talking about a mass shooting, which is much more rare, but again, has a, inordinate impact on the community around where it happens. So these are different problems that require different thinking about how to solve them. But, removing all guns from our society is just not going to happen.
That's Mark Fullman with Mother Jones. I must say I was very struck while researching for today's program, the statistics that I mentioned at the top of the hour here, that 93 people a day are shot dead in this country. 93. That's like, a small airplane dropping every day. And there would be a lot of coverage of that if it were happening in an airplane. But because it happens in isolated incidents across the country, we tend not to notice it. Let me read a couple of emails first, and then we're going to switch to talking about the big news out of Washington, D.C. this week. In addition to the shooting, we'll be talking about the Russian investigation, which President Donald Trump has now confirmed is personally directed at him, as well as some of his staff. And we'll be talking about the efforts of the Senate Republicans to push through an overhaul of Obamacare without letting anyone see what's in the bill. But first, a couple of emails on this. First from Janelle. As Martin Luther King said, the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. We reap what we sow. You don't need religious overtones to understand that you can be the world's largest arm dealer, but don't expect peace at home. And then an email from Howard, quote, political polarization on this issue cuts straight to the paradox at the foundations of this country. The political right insists on the individual right to bear arms, and the left insists on the communal right to limit the individual for public safety. The rest of the world seems more willing to promote the rights of the community, but here in the United States, the cult of the individual has consistently won out. How can we get those in power to focus on balancing these competing forces? That's Howard's email. And now we've got about 15 minutes left in the show. Let's talk about the big news in Washington this week. The Senate trying to push through Obamacare overhaul, but not showing the bill to anyone. Amanda Marquardt, you mentioned earlier today the one piece of journalism that you singled out as superb this week was by Vox, where they went up and basically put a microphone into the face of Republican senators and asked them what was in the bill. Did any of them, any of these senators know what was in the bill, or were they just stonewalling and trying to not tell the reporter what they knew?
I mean, it's pretty clear. You can kind of figure out, I mean, this is a teeny bit of speculation, but I think it's well-reasoned conjecture from what's going on, that what the reason that the Senate's Committee on the healthcare bill is unwilling to talk about what's going on is not that they don't know, it's that they are full well aware that their plan is to come up with something that is very much like what passed out of the House, which is incredibly unpopular, and I would point out is unpopular in both red states and blue states. It's unpopular from sea to shining sea, and they're kind of just hoping, I think, that they can just not talk about it, pass it, and get away with that. And I think it's interesting. It's something that I've never seen before in all the years I've been a journalist, and I'm afraid it's going to work. Just like Mitch McConnell's like strategy of simply refusing to have a hearing on Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court and expecting it to sort of fall out of the news cycle worked like a charm.
But in this case, you're talking about a bill that's going to remove health care coverage from 23 million Americans. That's a little different than an extra seat on the Supreme Court. Isn't the risk to Republicans going into the 2018 congressional elections awfully high to try this?
Well, my guess is whatever the final bill is going to be, what it's going to do is it's going to leave Obamacare in place for a couple more, at least another election cycle or two, so that nobody feels the immediate political impact of it. In fact, they may be counting on there being a Democrat in the president's seat when the effects start to be felt. And then, you know, knowing what we know of politics, if there is, in fact, a Democrat in the White House, when their repeal bill starts to go into effect, that person will get blamed, not the Republicans. So, I mean, the whole thing is just sleaze from beginning to end. And I think that they're aware that if people lose their health care, they're going to punish them at the polls. But I think the hope here is that people don't realize that their health care is going to disappear in 4 years.
That's Amanda Marquardt with Salon. I want to read out the phone number here again for those of us who those of you who might want to join us. We're talking now about the other news in Washington, D.C. this week, the Russia investigation, which is now touching President Trump personally, and the Senate Republicans' efforts to push through an overhaul of Obamacare without letting anyone know what's in the bill. Here's the number, 866-798-8255, and you can send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And by the way, if you've got a show idea for us, send us an email there as well. We'd love to hear about it. Mark Fulman, you've been directing, I think you said, Mother Jones' coverage of the Russia investigation. Can you talk a little bit about this, I think, rather extraordinary development? The President of the United States, not only is he now under investigation for Russia's alleged interference in last year's 2016 election, but the President himself has confirmed that. Now, he's confirmed it by complaining about it, but that's a pretty big deal, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's a big deal. Although, to clarify one point, it's never been confirmed that Trump himself was under investigation for potential collusion with the Russians in the election interference. But what he is under investigation for now is obstruction of justice, which he has confirmed as of, you know, this morning. Himself on Twitter. So it is absolutely extraordinary situation and indicative of just what a colossal political mess this is for the Trump White House. I think that, you know, it's been in the headlines for so long now that perhaps people are starting to get a little bit used to it. But when you step back and sort of survey the number of developments we've seen in this case, in this story over the last few weeks, and particularly since Trump fired the FBI director James Comey on May 9th, it's just incredible how much has unfolded. And I think we're still relatively early in these sprawling investigations that are going on, and now with, you know, the special counsel Robert Mueller. So in some sense, this story is unraveling very quickly. It's even for those of us who focus on it professionally 24/7, it's daunting to try to keep up with everything. And I think it's going to touch every corner of what the Trump administration is doing and hobble his presidency for the foreseeable future. It really already has.
It was reported today, I believe, by the Washington Post, but you guys correct me if I'm wrong, that Mr. Mueller, who, of course, is the special investigator, special counsel now investigating this, former FBI director himself, that he is requesting interviews with the CIA director, the NSA director, the director of national intelligence, in other words, the three top sort of spy masters of the United States. He's going to be interviewing them, and this supposedly is the reason that people are speculating, at least, and now Trump himself has confirmed, that Mr. Mueller is looking into a potentially obstruction of justice. Mark Follman, can you tell us any more about that? Can you confirm that that's what's going on right now?
Well, that was reported in the Washington Post this week, that the special counsel's investigation is now actively pursuing that. And, you know, a lot of it is just out in plain sight at this point, including with what Trump himself has done. It's absolutely remarkable. I mean, since he fired James Comey, talking about, you know, his interview with Lester Holt on NBC, where he said, you know, I did it because of this Russia thing. He has, you know, made a number of very tendentious political comments about the investigative process and calling it a political witch hunt and all these things that, you know, essentially he's appears to have been building an obstruction case against himself in the public square. You combine that with, you know, a lot of the details we learned from Comey's testimony, you know, the alleged pressure on Comey to quash the investigation into Michael Flynn, all sorts of things here that point to what I think, you know, most reasonable people would look at as strong circumstantial evidence, if not direct evidence, that Trump has tried to interfere with investigation by our government into this attack on our country by a foreign adversary. The stakes are remarkably serious.
You know, people say that Donald Trump, even before he was president and even before he was a presidential candidate, thrives in an atmosphere of chaos, and it puts his opponents off balance. And yet, surely, this can't be the kind of chaos that has any kind of a good outcome for the White House, can it, Amanda Marcotte?
No, I don't think it can. I mean, I think people mistake the fact that Donald Trump is somebody who creates chaos, is impulsive and childish, and enjoys power plays that lead to chaotic situations, with him being some kind of mastermind. You know, I mean, I take a dim view of everything that's happened to us in the past couple of years in this country and think that we just kind of had bad, really bad luck, that a number of things kind of fell in a certain direction that allowed us to elect this guy into office. But make no mistake, he is not in control. Like, a person who is in control wouldn't be, you know, going on Twitter on a daily basis and saying things that implicate him in pretty serious crimes. It's kind of amazing, actually.
Let's try and get one more quick call in here before we end the show. Denise in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that Russian interference. I think that we have an obsession with it. That election is a distraction. I mean, the obsession with Russian interference is a distraction and hypocritical. The U.S. is noted for interfering all over the world in elections and behind regime change, especially to put in power dictatorial governments.
And how is that a distraction from what is it being being distracted from?
Well, you talk about you spend a lot of time on the Russian interference in our election, and you neglect to mention that the United States has been doing this for years and years, endless years, all over the world, interfering with people's elections and putting in power dictatorial regimes. So that's what we do, and I haven't heard a word about making that comparison at all.
Can I bring in Mark Fulman? I must say, though, the KLW, Mother Jones, The Nation magazine, where I write, Salon, I think we've all made that very clear that the United States has a history of overthrowing and overthrowing governments, much less interfering with elections. But Mark Fulman, you want to tackle that in the last minute here?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, with all due respect to that point, you know, what we do with foreign policy, you know, critique it how you may, it's really irrelevant to tackling the question of what's going on with our electoral process, which is fundamentally important to our system. I mean, if we can't trust our election process to have integrity and to be fair and accurate, we're in big, big trouble. And that's why the American news media and the political establishment, or at least some of it, is intensely focused on this, because this is a problem that's not going away. Everything we're hearing from the intelligence community analyzing this threat is that this is, you know, it's off to the races for Putin and others who try to meddle in our with cyber attacks and in our democratic process. It's in their interest to undermine us, and they appear to have done so quite successfully in this last election cycle. It's very troubling.
That's Mark Fulman. Amanda Marcotte, a final word from you on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a popular talking point in some corners of the left, and I understand why it is, but I feel like a lot of people aren't actually looking at the direct history of that. We have done that in the past, but it is something that the Obama administration made really great pains to stop doing. You know, that Ronald Reagan and other right-wing presidents in the past did a lot of these kind of interfering behaviors, doesn't give carte blanche to the Russians forever and ever to dismantle our democracy through, you know, subversive means.
That's Amanda Marcotte with Salon. We're going to have to leave it there for the show. We've had an excellent panel here. We've been speaking with Mark Fulman. He's the National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones Magazine. Amanda Marcotte, she reports on American politics for Salon. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Curtis Lee of the Los Angeles Times. Sorry we couldn't get to all of the phone calls and emails, but thanks so much for joining us. And let me just add that coming up on Monday, we'll be rebroadcasting a conversation about the documentary Water and Power, A California Heist. That film is scheduled to air on National Geographic June 25th. This is Your Call Radio, produced at KALW. You can listen to our past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Ali Budner produced today's show. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. David LaTulip is our studio engineer. I'm Mark Hertzgard, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.